20 years ago, there were no Starbucks locations in New York City. By 1995, there were 15. And today, it seems as though you can't walk five blocks in Manhattan without coming across at least one of their stores. On today's Backstory, we look at how Starbucks grew to become a worldwide brand. And joining me now is Mark Pendergrass, an investigative journalist and author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to my show today. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. When did the first Starbucks store open?
In 1971, and it was one of many such little sort of boutique, kind of hippie grassroots roasters that were opening around the country at that time when people were rediscovering the joys of freshly roasted coffee beans.
And was Seattle a particular hotbed for all of this?
It became a hotbed for all of this, but at the time, no, it wasn't.
Was Starbucks very different from other Seattle coffee houses that opened in the 70s, or the ones in San Francisco, for that matter?
Well, San Francisco had a longer history of coffee houses, going back to the, well, going way back to when Jim Folger started a coffee roasting company there during the Gold Rush period. But you know, there's places like the Cafe Trieste and things like that in San Francisco that started back in the 50s. When I say all around the country, I'm not sure there was another roaster in Seattle in 1971. These guys, it was three college friends who had been touring Europe, and of course Europe has this tradition of decent coffee. And they were lamenting the fact that they didn't have a good coffee source, except for up in Vancouver at Murchie's and down in Berkeley at Pete's. And they particularly liked Pete's coffee, which had begun in 1966. And so Alfred Pete sort of helped them and roasted their beans for them for a while. And that's what they wanted to do, was to start another Pete's, basically.
And people in San Francisco now tell you Pete's is a lot better than Starbucks. But Starbucks is a lot bigger. And have they always been known for their very dark roasted beans, which some people will tell you taste a bit burned?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you should say that about Pete's, because the history of this is the three guys who started Starbucks were named Jerry Baldwin, Gordon Bowker, and Zev Siegel. And of those three, the only one who really went on in coffee was Jerry Baldwin, and he bought Pete's. So, and he's now sort of an emeritus. He's retired, but he's the one who has turned Pete's into what it is today. And he is not terribly happy with what has become of Starbucks. He's kind of, because his vision was basically to keep things small and to maintain, you know, mostly a local base, although Pete's expanded somewhat.
And then it's when they sold to somebody else that the explosion occurred?
That's right. What happened was Jerry hired a salesman named Howard Schultz, who had actually been selling them some of their supplies for the coffee. And they sent Howard Schultz to Italy for some kind of a convention. And he was in Milan, and he was just really taken with the whole culture and the panache and the romance and the theater of the espresso house and of the barista who was pulling the shots, and you know, it was just very elegant. And he thought, you know, this is what we could do back home. I should talk to those guys at Starbucks and get them to make espresso drinks, because all they did was to roast beans and sell the beans, and people were supposed to go home and grind them and make them. So he went back and he said, listen, guys, this is what you ought to do. And they were not interested. They didn't want to be bothered with all that stuff. It wasn't their vision. They just wanted to roast really good beans. And so they allowed Howard to introduce espresso in one of his own shops for a while. Then he formed his own little coffee shop And eventually what happened was when Jerry bought out Pete's, he was sort of running back and forth between Starbucks and Pete's, and it was kind of overextended. And he eventually sold Starbucks to Howard Schultz in 1987.
This is almost like the McDonald's story with Ray Kroc, supplying them initially with malted milk machines and eventually changing the whole McDonald's culture.
Yeah, I think it's quite similar, actually.
Now the Schultz stores were called Il Giornale. So did they become the model for the Starbucks stores of today?
Yes, they did, basically. Although he learned, you know, he learned that Il Giornale didn't mean much to people. and Starbucks was a better name. But, instead of calling drinks small, medium, or large, he called them short, tall, or grande. And he called a double espresso a doppio macchiato and things like that. He established this whole lingo.
Well, would most Italians recognize a drink served in a Starbucks?
Sort of. He kind of Americanized the drinks in a lot of ways. For instance, yeah, Italians would recognize a cappuccino, but they would only drink a cappuccino at breakfast. You would never have a latte or any of these, you know, milk products at any other time of the day. And probably the sizes are a little different, but
and they're a little sweeter, aren't they?
Well,
the Starbucks drinks can get pretty sugary.
Well, I think you can sort of control the amount of sugar by what you choose to tell them to put in.
Uh-huh.
But certainly the espresso that you have in Italy also is going to have probably not as high quality beans. They use a lot of Robusta beans, generally speaking.
So Starbucks is actually making a better product than what inspired it.
Maybe. It depends on how you like it.
Well, wasn't this an immediate success? Were they surprised by how many people were flocking to these coffee houses?
It was an immediate success, yeah, and people did flock. Howard Schultz, from the very beginning, had plans to make this a national and then an international drink. He was sort of like the, quite similar to the McDonald's story. And so he had to convince his investors to lose money for quite a few years as he was expanding, which he eventually turned the corner. Like in 1987, Starbucks lost $330,000. By 1989, they lost $1.2 million. It took them a while to turn the corner, but by the end of 1991, there were over 100 stores, and they had $57 million in sales, and he was about to take it public. So you can basically see that he had this master plan and that he was going to do it.
He took it public in June 1992, but they still hadn't moved on to the East Coast. So this was all just, I shouldn't say just, but this was all a West Coast success story at that point.
Well, he went to Chicago, where they didn't do all that well initially. And they actually went down into Los Angeles, which nobody expected them to do well because, you know, it's kind of hot there. And this is coffee we're talking about. It's supposed to, you know, supposed to be where people are cool, that they enjoy coffee. And guess what? It did really well. And then they ended up buying out the Coffee Connection, which was a much-loved chain in the Boston area, and turning them into Starbucks. And then they invaded New York, as you spoke of. And so they've been going kind of ever since.
My guest is Mark Pendergrast, who has written a book about coffee called Uncommon Grounds, A History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. Is it true that recovering cocaine addicts helped Starbucks early on?
recovering cocaine addicts. This I don't know.
Ah, actually, there is an interesting story there, but I guess it didn't make it into your book. We'll talk about it some other time.
Oh,
on
no,
show.
I want to hear it.
I was just told that recovering cocaine addicts helped Starbucks early on. I thought everybody knew the story, and I was going to learn about it from you.
Oh.
Well, anyway, but it is interesting that Starbucks has developed a wonderfully friendly image. Was that there from the start as well? Lots of charity giving. They have health insurance and stock options for their workers. They really do seem to be friendly and efficient. Do they train their workers well?
They train their workers very well, to the point that they've been accused of being sort of like a cult, you know, how people get that glazed, happy look on their faces. But they're very, very charity-minded. They've been the largest contributor to CARE for quite some time. They also make a huge amount of money. I mean, you know, year after year after year, they are making a lot of dough for themselves. There was some bitterness when they went public as to who got stock options and who did not. And then they began to hire people who had worked at fast food franchises like Burger King or Taco Bell or something like that. And a lot of the early people like Kevin Knox, who had, you know, put everything into it and believed that everything was going to be always kind of romantic, were disaffected by the sort of corporate people taking over. But they've kept this idea of treating their workers well, and they also have introduced something that's quite interesting, which is a kind of a code of conduct for the people who supply their beans. Now, because they're large, a lot of people love to hate Starbucks the same way that they love to hate Coca-Cola.
Or Walmart.
Or Walmart, or McDonald's, or whatever else. But Starbucks has actually been a fairly responsible corporate citizen. They pay top dollar for their beans. If you are one of their suppliers and they want you to be a regular supplier and you fit their criteria, then they'll guarantee you a market for your beans. And coffee is a notoriously difficult product to grow and sell, and it's very volatile, the price. So that's been a very important thing. The other thing that's interesting about Starbucks is that nobody knew how they would do when they went to, for instance, Japan or Germany, which has, you know, its gemütlich little cafes all over the place. Why would anybody want to go to a Starbucks there? Japan, which had its own coffee house tradition, but everybody smoked there, and Starbucks won't let anybody smoke. How would that do? Well, it did fabulously well, particularly with young people. And the same thing is true in Europe, wherever they've gone.
And that's interesting because they've gone to the place that inspired them. They're now opening up Starbucks in Vienna and Italy, for that matter. What has been the response of those nice little old coffee houses that are now suffering in the same way that supermarkets and other stores suffer when Walmart comes to town?
Well, some of them are adapting and opening sort of more American-style places. Some of them are, you know, they were attracting the same clientele they had before, which was more elderly people. In general, wherever Starbucks is open, they claim that the market for coffee gets better for everybody. And to a certain degree, I think that's been true most places in the United States. I'm not sure how true it is of Europe. But that's because I don't know the market figures off the top of my head. I would suspect that wherever you get a certain concentration of coffee houses, that it probably does, you know, there's going to be some shakeout, but that generally speaking, you get more clients going.
But they're so much in competition with themselves. The people joke about there being a Starbucks on opposite sides of the same street in the Times Square area. There are at least 8 Starbucks stores just within a 4-block radius of our radio station. there are four Starbucks, and I can't imagine that they can all turn big profits.
Believe me, they are turning big profits, or they wouldn't be there.
And now they've gotten, they're doing very well in the music business and just announced they're going to go into the movie DVD business.
Well, I'm not sure that they're going exactly into the movie DVD business. I think that they're doing sort of joint ventures where they will help distribute something. Are they actually making movies?
No, they'll be selling them, but they will be all repackaging the same, I think, as they repackage music on their CDs.
Right.
Now, there has been a backlash. The Starbucks was targeted during the 1999 World Trade Organization protests in Seattle.
And some people
are concerned also that they charge a very high price for their fair trade coffee. Do you just see this thing as growing and growing, or is Dunkin' Donuts going to wind up eating into their profits?
You know, I don't think they charge a whole lot for their fair trade coffee. I think they charge about the same as they do for their regular coffee.
Yeah, but you never can get it, actually.
Yeah. Well, they've been accused of not pushing fair trade enough, but the fact is they sell more fair trade coffee than any other roaster in the country does. I live in Vermont. Green Mountain Coffee Roasters sells a much higher percentage of its coffee as fair trade, but Starbucks sells more in quantity, so it's a little bit hard to fault them on that.
And is there a Starbucks in Essex Junction, Vermont, where we're talking to you?
No, but there's one in Burlington.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting because they opened right across the street from the store that has the same name as my book. Uncommon Grounds is a very fine coffee shop in downtown Burlington. And when Starbucks opened, you know, a little catty corner from them, everybody was worried about how that would be. But they're both doing fine.
And they've done it all.
There's a little coffee shop around the corner called Muddy Waters, and so is the Radio Bean. There's all kinds of coffee houses in Burlington.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us on Backstory today. We've been telling the story of Starbucks. Mark Pendergrass, who is the author of Uncommon Grounds, A History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World.
We'll find out about that cocaine now.
Okay.